All right, good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to the final session of SharePoint Conference 2012. You survived. Give yourselves a hand. Woo! How many of you feel like your brains are bleeding a little bit after this week of information overload? Yeah, I can definitely relate. This has been a crazy week. I hope you've enjoyed it. I hope you've feel like you've gotten a lot out of it, not just from content from sessions like this, but even more importantly, perhaps, from meeting each other. And learning what each other are doing, because that's what the real world is about. It's not necessarily what we're even doing up here on stage. It's what you're doing with your SharePoint in your environments, on-prem, in the cloud, 2007, 2010, 2013, 2001, 2003, whatever the case may be. I hope you've had a chance to really connect and learn with each other. And I've mentioned this in all of my sessions, but I'm really, truly sincere that I hope from my heart that the conversation continues beyond today. I hope you travel home, that you have time to enjoy the chance to meditate on what you've learned and digest it, and then digest a wonderful Thanksgiving dinner for those of you who are Americans and are going to be enjoying that holiday next week. And then I hope that you're able to turn around and continue talking with me. And my email address is on the slide. It's going to be on the next slide as well. Please do keep the conversation going. My job is to help you succeed with SharePoint, and I can only do that when I know what you've learned. Good, bad, ugly, indifferent, otherwise, what questions you've got, and I definitely look forward to that. So I know many of you have been to my sessions before. I'll keep the biography very, very short here, but my name is Dan Holm. I'm an MVP in SharePoint Server and have been for about 6 years, was an MVP in Active Directory before that. I work for a company, my own company called Intellium. We provide consulting services to mostly Fortune-caliber organizations around the world in every vertical, corporate, government, and academic. So I'm spending a lot of time on the road traveling. One of my favorite customers is NBC, for whom I have been the Microsoft Technologies Consultant during the Olympics for the last 4 games. And I write books, including the SharePoint 2010 Training Kit. And some of you were kind enough to stop by the O'Reilly booth yesterday and pick up a signed copy of that. So that was great meeting you. And the few weeks a year that I'm home, I live on Maui. So if ever you happen to stop by Maui, give me a shout. If it's one of those weeks, I'd love to meet you and show you a little bit of my home. But the most important information on this slide is my contact information. Email address is there. The URL in the middle of the slide is my SkyDrive that has all of the slide decks. I just finished uploading to this slide deck and the one from yesterday. The scripts are having problems uploading. I think they probably have some virus scanning that's catching the fact that they're PowerShell, so I'm going to work on renaming those and re-uploading them. So the scripts will get there probably later on today, if not for sure over the weekend. And then on Facebook and Twitter, I am Dan Holm. Something happened just this week. I don't know what's going on with Facebook, but you know they just reached the billion user mark or something like that. It seems like at least 10% of those are now not real people. And over this week, I've gotten 150 friend requests from people who clearly aren't, you know, SharePoint people or real people. I'm getting a lot of very attractive single women and men from Burma and Malaysia. So what I would ask is if you friend me on Facebook, please just say a word, you know, saw you at the SPC or something so that I know, like, you're for real. And I look forward to continuing the conversation. Because I'm going to start ignoring friend requests on Facebook that I can't really figure out where they came from. It's too dangerous because then, of course, you all connect with each other by being my friend, and I want to protect you. So anyway, please do continue the conversation after today. And one last note, it's the last slide in the deck, and we're all going to want to get home. Please do fill in the evaluations. First of all, we as speakers are all trying to be the top speaker in the top session. So, of course, your ratings are important. But I will read each and every comment you make if you take time to actually say something. Your constructive criticism is very valuable. So in those comments, I really invest a lot of interest in making sure that these sessions, as they evolve, provide value. So in this particular session, we're going to be talking about how governance meets architecture and how to architect a scalable in SharePoint environment that is scalable not only from a size and performance perspective, but more importantly from a workload scalability perspective, meaning you build SharePoint to do one thing today and tomorrow you're asked to do something else with it. And also to ensure that you can enforce policies. How many of you were at AvePoint session that Jeremy and Dana just did downstairs? A couple of you? All right. There's going to be a little bit of overlap because Jeremy and I created some content together, but just a fair warning. But what this session is really designed to do is to bridge the gap between those sort of conceptual governance things that say, here's what governance should be. It should all be, you know, get together and around the table, sing kumbaya, and come out with a good service. And then the actual hard technical stuff. We're going to bridge that gap. And we're going to go from, my goal is to give you tools that allow you to actually go from talking to the business and finding out what they're trying to do, to really identifying hard requirements and then translating those into a technical architecture, and most importantly, creating a discussion so that you can make tough choices. Because unfortunately, SharePoint, unlike a lot of other technologies, is going to require tough choices. And you need to know what those choices are, because the biggest challenge you will face with SharePoint is not knowing what you don't know. And if you don't have a process to bubble those things up and discover what you don't know at the right time, you will end up making mistakes that you wish you hadn't made later. So I'm going to try to bridge that gap. It's going to be from business to technical. It will get quite technical as we continue on here. And to give you some very specific tools along the way. Oh, and by the way, I thank you guys so much for being here. I was so sure I'd have 10 people in this room. And the last session of the SPC, I was like, oh no, this is my favorite session. So I'm very grateful you guys came. So here's the agenda. We're gonna treat this like an onion, and we're gonna start with definitions and diagrams, so sort of setting the stage. Then we're going to do a really simple example that's the most straightforward, easy, no-brainer example as possible, just so we can really establish foundations and terminology and concepts. Then we're gonna look at the process in detail, and this is where you'll get your first real set of tools for taking business requirements and translating them into an architecture. And after that, we're going to go into the technical details that go into that process and the different scenarios that tend to be problematic from an architectural perspective. So it is going to be like an onion. We're going to start at the higher level. We're going to go down into deeper levels of detail. Because this is about planning and process and technology, this is not a demo session. Your demos are going to be a whole bunch of whiteboards that you'll see where we'll be drawing out different architectures and talking about the pros and cons of them. So that's the plan. So we're going to start with definitions and diagrams and really taking apart the title of this session. What is governance? What is workload scalability? What is policy-based management? And what are architectures? And all of this, in the end, boils down to the business having the need to do something. We are all in this room not because SharePoint is a cool technology, but because SharePoint solves business problems. That's why we have our jobs. And it really is about the business need. And the business is going to give us something to achieve, an outcome, and we're going to need to turn around and create a service that delivers that outcome. And those are the only two things the customer cares about, that they've told us what they want and that they get it, right? Everything in between is the magic goo, and that's what we're going to have to fill in, is what happens in between to translate that business need to a service. And notice it's a two-way arrow, because there's going to have to be a conversation along the way that allows you to make tough choices. So what is governance? Well, I've already mentioned in previous session, it comes from a Greek word that involves steering a ship, navigating a ship. And one of the interesting sort of outcomes of that is, first of all, governance is not the destination. You don't get governance. It's not somewhere you land. And I hate having clients tell me, we're starting a governance project because I know it's going to fail. You have to be in the water in order to steer the ship. You can't steer the ship on dry land just talking about it. So you have to be in the water to steer the ship. It's about how you get there, not where you are going. And very importantly, it's about how you work as a team to do that and how you communicate along the way. On the interweb and on sort of simple governance presentations, you'll see a definition of governance that sounds like this. Governance defines people, processes, and policies that deliver a service. And in that case, this is a little bit of repeat from yesterday, so I apologize for that for those of you who were in my session yesterday. But the challenge with that definition is the word deliver really hangs people up, because half of the community will think deliver means how you provide the service, how you secure it and control it and lock it down, that present tense of deliver. What are you doing to control that? Who's responsible for it? What processes and policies are there? And then a whole other side of the community is looking instead at how you get to that service. How you take the business need in and create change and innovate. And in that case, the word deliver is really talking about the new thing you are bringing into your environment, how you deliver something new. And in all reality, it's both of those things. Governance is a two-way bridge that helps you get both operations management, which is that delivery of the service in its end state, and change management, which is how you introduce that new change. And the people, process, and policy are on both sides of that. There are people and processes and policies that define how you control and operate the service. There's also people, processes, and policies that determine how you create the service along the way. So governance both consumes people, process, and policy, and it produces people, process, and policy. And if we sort of look at it from a visual perspective, I have a day-long governance workshop that I do with a number of customers. Governance is really all of these things wrapped into one with a series of processes that guide you through it. And the main reason I put the slide up, as I did yesterday, is I want to acknowledge the fact that governance is a big thing. It is hairy, it is complicated potentially, but it is straightforward if you break it down. And today in this session, we are only going to be focused on one subset of the governance picture, and we're going to be focused on how you take business needs and translate them into an architecture that you design an architecture that supports the governance policies and workloads that you're delivering. So while we're going to be focused on that small piece of governance, I absolutely recognize this has to enable the rest of the process that follows that. The development, the deployment, the management, the measurement, and the modification of that service over time. And if you do this part right, this really, if there's only one thing you do correctly with governance, if you do what I'm going to share with you right today, it almost guarantees you've done everything that needs to happen before that correctly, and you will be able to do everything after it correctly. This is the one thing that if there's only one part of governance you get right, this is it, because it ensures the rest is happening, really. So what is workload scalability? Well, workload scalability is simply the idea that you're going to create your SharePoint service to do something. You're going to define a business need. You're going to translate that into a service through a bunch of processes and magic goo, and most of which we'll be talking about today. And then, as soon as you're done, business is going to come up with another need. And you're going to need to translate that into an additional element of your service. So you need to have the processes, the technologies, the understandings to be able to scale that from a workload perspective, not just a size and growth perspective, but a workload perspective. And last but not least, policy-based management. Policy-based management, and for those of you who are in Dana and Jeremy's excellent session just before this, they touched on this. Policy-based management is a critical element of governance and of having a good service. And it's really easy to understand if we start thinking about a scenario. A scenario might be that you're going to be working with resumes or CVs, for those of you who aren't American, in your SharePoint environment. And those CVs, those resumes, need to be governed in a way that they are secure, that they're records that are maintained for a certain number of years, and then they're deleted. And that might be your reality. Now, how do you know that reality, and how do you manage to? Well, first, there's a policy. That policy may be a legal external requirement that's coming down on you. In the EU, they clearly define how long resumes should be maintained. Or it might be an internal policy. For example, Microsoft has a policy that their core software code has to be extraordinarily secure for obvious reasons. So it might be internal or external, but there is a policy. Now, one of the interesting things about policies is they never tell you exactly what to do in a specific technology. They are technology agnostic. They're information specific, often, or they should be anyway. They tell you how the information should be made accessible and available and stored and presented and delivered. Then there are people who have to interpret that policy. People have to say, well, I think what that policy means is X, Y, and Z. And they interpret that policy, and that interpretation is often an interesting part of the discussion. And once they've interpreted that policy, there's often the next thing that is defined is the process for how that policy will be implemented. And in many cases, that's where the discussion ends. People follow a process, or you hope they follow a process. You cross your fingers, and maybe you measure it, if you're lucky and smart, in the back end to see if it's being followed. But then you also, if you really want to have a full governance story, want to put technology into the mix in a way that helps automate that process, which is something we talked about yesterday, and helps you measure and manage that process to ensure it is actually working, so that you have enforced the policy with your technology. And with all those pieces in place, you end up with managed information. Your resumes, your CVs are being managed correctly, or a managed solution, or a managed service, or a managed workload, whatever you want to call it. It's those people, those policies being interpreted by people, being turned into processes and technologies that make it managed. So, out of all of that, we have a couple of categories that we're going to be really thinking about related to policies. The first is information architecture, and information architecture is about how you describe content and how you classify it. So, in this case, we have to think about the fact that we're working with resumes as a class of information. Information management then takes over and says, okay, how does that class of information need to be managed? If, for example, here we see that these are records that they need to be maintained for 5 years, and there's a security implication for permissions. And last but not least, there's a information lifecycle or information management component that says we have to maintain this for 5 years and then it must be deleted. Last but not least, there's a service management element that involves like how much the uptime for the solution needs to be. What is the backup and restore scenario? What is the storage implication of holding these resumes for this long? What kind of storage platform do we need to support that? So policy, there's going to be policies that fall into those three big buckets of defining information and building an information architecture around it, managing the information correctly, and then providing it through a service that meets your requirements as well. And the final, then, sort of wrapping all these things together into a sort of one last whack at what is governance really, a couple of definitions. I use this definition. At the end of my one-day workshop, we sort of come to an understanding that governance defines how a service is managed, that's the operations management piece of it, and how it is evolved to deliver a business need. That's the change management part of it. And it all, the only thing that really matters in the end here is that you delivered business need. Microsoft has a nice definition in their Governance Resource Center, the SharePoint 2010 Governance Overview. As many of you who are in Jeremy and Dana's session saw this exact definition as well, which is governance is the set of policies, roles, responsibilities, and processes, and here are those keywords that guide, direct, and control, that's the steering of the ship, how an organization's divisions and IT teams cooperate, that's the two-way arrow, to achieve business goals, again, resulting in that key outcome for the business. The last piece of our title that we need to sort of level set here is architectures. And there's three architectures we're going to be working with as we dive into the details as well. The first of which is our logical architecture. So your logical architecture of SharePoint, starting with a farm that can have one or more web apps that can then have one or more content databases. Each of the content databases can have one or more site collections that have one or more sites. Sites have one or more lists and libraries. With folders and documents and all that sort of stuff. And then you have some associated architectural components of service applications, zones, and tenancies that get into the mix as well. These are just the logical building blocks that you have to work with as an architect. There's also physical building blocks, right? There's physical servers, virtual servers, cloud-based services that you have to work with. So you have a logical architecture sitting on top of a physical architecture. And last but not least, you have your information architecture. One of the most sort of visually compelling pieces of your information architecture is your sitemap. So that's why I chose this piece of information architecture, which is what you want to present to users so they can navigate through your environment. Now, of course, information architecture is bigger than just the sitemap, but it's a good picture. So those are our three architectures, and the thesis of this session is that there's a very tight relationship between governance and architecture that allow you to ensure scalability and policy-based management. So if we start with the business needs, the question is, what is the business really trying to achieve? That's what you're trying to answer. Governance needs to then take that business need and enumerate what I would call requirements. Now, I hate the word governance and I hate the word requirements, but I use them because it's what a lot of people can relate to easily without getting distracted. But requirements really, in this case, are things that will truly drive towards a technical design. And these, again, fall into those categories of information classification, information management, and service management. And we're going to get into more details of this. So governance takes the business need, which is really business-focused, and helps us get towards a set of what I would call technical requirements. And those requirements then have to become policies. So our policy in this scenario might be that when a resume is added to the system, it must be secured so that only HR can access that. And, of course, then that it has to be maintained for 5 years, and then it must be deleted. So that's where governance spits out people, policy, and process that then will need to be managed in the service. Architecture then takes those policies and those requirements and creates an actual logical and physical architecture that drives those people, policies, and processes into the technical service itself. So there's this logical progression of taking business needs, figuring out what the real requirements are, determining what the policies and processes are that will be necessary to manage the service, and then architecting the service to support that. And by the way, I know a lot of people are taking pictures of these. Please remember you can download these slides. And I'm going to give you the slides Because there's going to be more, so your camera's going to run out of batteries. I can guarantee you. There are, and I'm giving you the PowerPoint slides, so if you want to take these and chop them up and show them to your teams and whatever, please do. I mean, my point is to give you tools here that will help you. So let's start with, let's then move to a simple, familiar example that takes us through that process fully. And again, the example is super simple. I just want to level set a couple more terms and concepts here. So the simple example is that the business comes to us and says, we've got two parts of the organization that need to collaborate. HR needs to work on 75 random HR documents. Engineering needs to work on 25 engineering documents. That's the business need. Now, our next step is going to then to pull the people together to hash that business need into something that drives towards more technical requirements, more service-oriented policies and such. So we need to translate that business need into solution requirements. This is going to be a process that we will go into a lot of detail about that will take those business needs and turn them into solution requirements, which will be red in our picture here. And in this case, let's assume that what we talk about around the table of governance is we talk about security, permissions. And we identify the, and from that discussion and that consideration, so governance guides us to consider this, we need to then determine that the real issue is here is that we need to isolate departmental collaboration, which makes sense. HR needs to be secure from engineering and vice versa. And we have legal requirements, particularly around HR, that specify that anything with personal information must be very, very secure. So governance guides us to think about permissions. Obviously, we all would anyway. As we think about it, we enumerate, we bubble up the real requirements for isolating departmental collaboration and really securing HR documents. We now have to translate those into policies for how the service will be managed. And so in this case, out of this come the fact that the service must be managed to ensure the security of the departmental documents here. Now, there's two ways to manage to that policy. And one way is what I call encouraging the policy. And this is, for those of you in Dana and Jeremy's session, they talked about this as sort of a manual thing. And this is going to seem really stupid to you because you would never do this, but play along with me. The idea is you know that HR and engineering need to be secure. Your choice is, are you going to enforce that or are you just going to hope it happens, right? So you could, if you really wanted to, put both of those sets of documents in a single folder, and you could go to the HR people and say, please don't look at the engineering documents, and you could go to the engineers and say, please don't look at the HR documents, right? Of course it's silly. Yeah, you're welcome to laugh. That's what I call encouraging a policy. Now, you could back that up with some measurement and some rewards and punishments, yes, but you're not really enforcing the policy at that point. That's what I call encouraging. And that's what you often get when all you do is take a policy and determine who it applies to and then have a process, and that's it. You have a process, you've done your job, you cross your fingers and you hope it actually works. Now, of course, we all laugh because we know what we would really do is we'd create a folder for HR with a set of permissions for HR. We'd create a folder for engineering with a set of permissions for engineers. And then we actually are able to enforce that policy. And the two key terms, there's a couple of key terms here. One is encouragement versus enforcement. And we laugh because it's so easy to enforce this kind of policy, right? I mean, setting up two folders is basically zero cost. But the real point is by the end of the session, we're going to have talked about lots of scenarios where the cost is far from zero. And that's where tough decisions have to be made. Because there are going to be situations where you do, in your organization, I'm sure you do already, decide to encourage policies. And you have them out there. This is our policy. But there's no way to ensure that it's actually being followed and enforced. Within that concept of enforcing a policy, you are able to enforce a policy because you have two pieces of technology. You have a control that applies the policy. In this case, the control is the permissions. It's the access control list on that folder. That is your control. It's a switch. It's a configuration that you can throw as an administrator. And you have a scope to which you can apply that control. Permissions can be applied at the folder level. And you can then ensure that any document within that folder is being appropriately managed to that policy. So as long as you have a scope and a control, you're good to go, and you have the option of enforcing that control. And then all you have to do is think about what's the cost of doing that, and in this case, it's basically zero. So real simple example, right? And everyone's cool with the terms and the pieces that I've thrown out here? All right, so at this point, what we've laid out is the idea that to support this scenario, as far as we have defined it, which is from a permissions perspective, we could go as low in our architecture as a folder, and that would allow us to enforce the policy. Now, you can set permissions on items and documents, but that's not enforcing the policy, because every time a new document is added, you're going to have to set the permissions. So the control in this case of ACLs goes way down and actually goes way up to the top level site in your site collection. But to enforce it, the lowest level you can be at is at the folder level. And now we've put technology into the mix. We've put a control and a scope that allows us to enforce that policy. So we've taken business needs, we've translated those needs into solution requirements, focused in this case on permissions. We translated those requirements into policies and have been able to determine that we could either encourage or enforce that policy. And now we translate that management policy into an architecture by identifying where the scope and control is that supports the enforcement. And last but not least, and we come up with that minimal architecture. And last but not least, we measure the cost of enforcing that policy, which is basically zero, and it's a no-brainer in this particular example. The other thing we want to look at is what would be the risk of non-enforcement. If we were to put all those documents in a single folder and there was a breach of confidentiality or security or privacy, what would be the risk? What's the cost to the business? What's the probability of that risk? And calculating out the risk of non-enforcement. Because often, you have two ways to communicate a decision to invest. You can communicate the return on investment, or you can communicate what I call the risk of inaction, which is how much are we potentially exposing the business to by not doing it correctly. And in some discussions, our return on investment is more resonant. In other discussions, risk is more resonant to the organization. So to wrap all of this sort of simple foundational piece up, we'll come to slides that are red, that are just guidance. And the point with these slides is if you're able to sit down with your team and look at these slides and everyone agrees that this is the way it is and we've achieved these things, then you're in good shape. So these are your check marks along the road to making this all happen. And this is the easy one, sort of, so to speak. You establish the policy, you identify the scope and control that supports the enforcement, and then you measure the cost of enforcement versus the risk of non-enforcement, the return on investment or the a risk of inaction, risk of inadequacy, risk of inertia, so however you want to define that. And all of this boils down to what I think is the most important equation in governance, or in architecture, I should say, which is that architecture is not about technology. It is about a combination of understanding the technology, in this case, being able to identify those controls and the scopes, the technical expertise, a process, and compromise. And it's about having a process that allows the technical expertise to come up at the right time and be considered at the right time, and then for the stakeholders to sit around a table and make a compromise and understand what the benefits of the compromise are and what the risks are to the compromise that was made. Now, at this point, we talked about folders. That was a super simple example. Many of you who, if your business came to you and said, hey, we've got these two departments that need to collaborate, you would probably not give them folders in a document library. You'd probably give them either a library or perhaps a site, maybe even something higher than that. Let's assume that you think departments should have sites. And this was very common back in, say, 2007. So you get to this kind of possibility where you say, okay, each department is going to get their own site. That's not a terrible decision from a security perspective, because, of course, your sites also have the ability to scope security. So sites act as a scope for security, and that would achieve your goals of permissions. And if you chose to give your team sites, what you were probably doing naturally is you were thinking, well, if HR is going to share documents, they might also want to eventually have their own calendar and their own contact list and their own tasks lists. And so what you were also doing as you did that in your head was you were taking into account another consideration besides permissions. You were taking into account functionality and sites scope functionality as well. So the sets of features, the types of content that are in those sites are scoped there as well. So that's and all I'm indicating here is that many of us naturally take into account a wider set of considerations. Now, if we move up one more level, we'll start seeing why that very common architecture that came out of people in SharePoint 2007 has some serious weaknesses. And if you are still in this architecture, I hope that at least I convince you that this is not a good one. Many of you are already past this point, but let's cover this. If you have each department in a single site collection, the benefit is that every time you add a new department, it gets added to the global navigation. There's a lot of nice little benefits of from an administration perspective of having everything in a single site collection. But the problem is you're not actually going to be able to achieve all of the real requirements of your business workloads. For example, even with the HR scenario that we've been working with so far, is HR content truly secure in this environment? From a permissions perspective, yes, we can scope permissions to the HR site, but that's not the only element of security. There's also a consideration that I call ownership. Now, the consideration of ownership from a technical perspective is membership in the site collection administrators group. Because if you're in the site collection administrators group, you own the entire site collection, you have full control to all content, and you cannot be blocked. So that particular control or consideration of ownership is only scoped at the site collection level. And if you have only one site collection, the danger and the likelihood is that in that site collection, you've got your entire help desk, all of IT, a couple of engineers because they want to do things in their site that require site collection administrator level permissions. And all of a sudden, HR content is vulnerable to people across those different categories of roles. So we really haven't achieved the original goal of separating out HR because ownership is scoped at the site collection level. If we really want to scope out ownership of security for HR, we really have to go a step further, which is to put it in its own site collection so that there is a scope within that site collection where we can limit membership in the site collection administrators group in a way that is acceptable to the business owners and all of those people who are interpreting the policies and how those apply to that particular workload. Here's a quick question.
Yeah, how about the user profile permissions and the farm administrators?
Farm administrators, that's certainly something you can consider as well. And actually, when we get up to the farm level, remind me about that and I'll talk about that. Because I know where you're going with that and it's worth talking about, assuming we've got some time. Now let's look at another scenario, quotas. So we all know what quotas are, storage management controls, right? So we don't want our storage to go up wild. There's two challenges I see with quotas in SharePoint as I go into customers, one of which is how many customers don't have quotas at all on their team sites. How many of you are willing to admit you don't have quotas on your team sites? All right. What happens when a user intentionally or more likely accidentally drags and drops their entire C drive into one of the document libraries in SharePoint 2013? Is your SQL Server ready for that terabyte from their laptop? Really? You've got to have quotas on your site collections. Even if they're high, have something that protects your storage infrastructure. And on your little to-do list for what you're going to do the day after Thanksgiving at work, make sure you put quotas on. You can change them later. You set up templates, and then you can go and update those templates later. But please have quotas. The second challenge I see is how many customers still think that in this architecture, we could actually give engineering and marketing a separate quota. They think that it's scoped at the site level. It's not. It's scoped at the site collection level. That's the only place it's scoped. So in this scenario, we could put on a quota, but engineering is going to upload 3 AutoCAD documents, 2 maps, and an image, and finance and marketing aren't going to stand a chance, right? They're going to eat the entire quota. And this is where you're then saying, you're going to engineering and you're saying, look, please don't upload too much. You know, you're in the same site collection as these guys over here, please. That's the encouragement risk that you're taking there. And so if you really want to enforce your storage management concern for engineering, you would want to scope them into their own site collection so that there you could apply and manage and enforce that policy. One last example is auditing. And this is one I've seen as I go into customers recently over the last year and a half or so. I'm finding that customers are starting to look at policies around them, and there's either new policies or they're reinterpreting the policies that were out there, and they're realizing, gosh, you know, we really should be heavily auditing certain workloads in our environment. Let's say we should be heavily auditing finance. The problem with auditing is that most of the controls end up being scoped at the site collection level in one way or another. And so if we're going to crank up auditing for finance workloads in our SharePoint architecture here, we're going to end up also auditing marketing and whoever else is in that site collection. And we're going to have a bigger site, bigger audit logs, tougher to store and backup, tougher to parse. And so if we want to scope auditing effectively, we would want to be breaking finance into its own site collection so that we could scope and manage and enforce the policies of auditing on that workload. So what we get to here is the concept that at the site collection level, there are some very critical information management controls, like ownership, administration, and audit settings, as well as service management controls, quotas. Now, we're going to start seeing these orange tables here, and these are going to be the giant checklists for you in your governance processes. You need to think about a workload and how each of these policy categories apply to it. Some of them are related to your service management, storage in this case. Some of them are related to information management, acquisition, delivery, presentation, storage, archiving of information. But there's a lot more controls at the site collection level, and this is a list of them. And we'll talk about some of these as we continue on here. But the bottom line is that these slides that you'll be seeing and that we'll be discussing are the settings that need to be considered in the process of governance because they impact your architectural decisions. If you have a new workload, a new demand coming in from the business, and you look at that workload on all of these dimensions, and they match one of your existing site collections 100%, then you can put that new workload into an existing site collection. If that new workload varies on any one of these dimensions, from a technical perspective, you would need to put it in a new site collection in order to enforce the policies. And then it becomes a question of what's the risk and the cost of putting it in its own site collection, and then having a discussion and a compromise to make that decision. So these orange slides, and there'll be plenty of them, are the policies and settings that you need to consider. So as far as policies and settings go, where we're heading with this is you need to be sure that you consider all of the available policies and all of the available settings as you go through the governance process. You've got to think about all of them and so that you can make an informed decision about the architecture for a particular new workload or solution. The reality is it's unlikely you're going to be able to consider all of them. And it's highly unlikely that you're really going to be able to manage all of them. Because what's different about SharePoint than, say, Exchange or Link or Windows desktops or Windows servers is that SharePoint isn't just a plumbing platform that you throw out and it delivers one thing, like email or, you know, Office. This is a solution, this is a platform that delivers business solutions. And those business solutions have rich, complex requirements that lead us into a place more than any other technology that many of us have had to deal with to make really seriously tough decisions. So it's unlikely you're going to be able to consider every policy, very unlikely you're going to be able to actually manage to all of them, but do your best. And figure out what you did well, allow yourself to make mistakes, and recognize those mistakes and do better the next time as you go through the continuous cycle of governance. Because again, it's all about learning about the technology, which I'm going to try and give you as much of as we continue through this session as possible, having a process that lets you think about the right things at the right time, and then making compromise. So at this point, these are the site collection scoped controls. These are the primary ones. Now, there are a lot more, and here's the trick. In 2007, for Moss, I wrote the white paper about this whole concept of management controls and scopes, and it was easy because this was the list, well, minus a few. Now, the list gets bigger and bigger and bigger all the time, and as soon as you add a third-party tool or a script that you've created, you can actually modify scopes in many ways. And so you've got to know enough about your environment to take into account what else has happened. And Microsoft, every 90 days, is going to be changing things in the cloud, right? So you're going to have to use this as a foundation to move forward, but at least these are the ones that tend to bubble up very quickly in the current world. And where we left off in our architecture was that each collaborative unit that we were supporting had their own site collection. In our case, just to keep it simple, it was a departmental example. But it could be a business unit, it could be a function, a project, a team. And the guidance as far as site collections and the architecture of those go, and this is somewhere that many of you have reached already, is that in the collaboration workload specifically, generally speaking, you're going to have separate site collections for every collaborative unit. Every business unit, department, team, function, project, because as each one of those things comes through the pipeline, you're going to look at that against all of those requirements, and you're not going to find that it fits in any existing site collection. Every new team has one little difference. And if you want to enforce and manage the policies related to that difference, then it's going to need to be in its own site collection quite often. And many of you have gotten to that point where today I look at most of my clients' collaborative environments, and they've figured out that those collaborative units need to be in separate site collections. But you have to be always aware of limits and boundaries. You cannot have an infinite number of site collections. And there's links to the white papers, to the technical documentation of what those limits and boundaries are. Those change regularly, and I think in the 2013 cycle, we're going to see them changing quite rapidly, in fact, for the better. We're going to see more and more scalability across these different dimensions. But you do have to be aware of limits and boundaries. And so you can't have a completely distributed architecture where every single thing is its own site collection. And there's one other challenge with architecture, is that as we move forward in our discussion of this architecture, certain things get harder. What's one of them?
Navigation.
That's one of the ones that comes up very quickly. I heard a couple others that we'll talk about here too. Navigation is one of the ones that comes up fastest. People are like, yeah, but if I create a new site collection, then it doesn't show up in the global navigation. Right. Yeah, that's a challenge. And in 2010, you have to hard code or buy third-party solutions to solve that problem. In 2013, what's the name of the feature that does that? Managed navigation. You can create a term set that then is consumed and presented as global navigation, and then that term set can create cross-site, cross-farm, cross-anything navigation. Now, as you hear about managed navigation, if you didn't hear much about it at this event, keep in mind managed navigation really encompasses two types of things with SharePoint 2013. One that's getting all of the press is the idea that you go into navigation and it dynamically generates based on search, and when you finally get to a node, what's underneath that node is coming up from search, so it's very dynamic, and that's great. But the other type of navigation is called simple link, where one of your terms in your term set is a hard-coded URL to a specific location. And that by itself will allow us to do a lot of this bridging across high levels of our architecture, where we want to get people to another farm or to another site collection or to another web app, because those things don't tend to change as frequently. So the higher levels will be supported by simple link navigation. The lower levels will be supported by the more dynamic navigation. If any of you work for ISVs, I can tell you what a great saleable solution will be, which is create web parts for SharePoint 2010 that consume the managed navigation for simple links, at least, from SharePoint 2013. So you could have a SharePoint 2013 service farm with managed metadata doing all your definition of terms, and then your 2010 content farms can be consuming that and getting people around. That would be a really easy little solution if you want to build an app and start making some money. I'm just saying. You can give me 10% if you want on the back end. Another challenge across a distributed architecture is content types. This was really a blocker in 2007, where people were like, well, if I have multiple site collections, I then have to define content types in each site collection, or I have to use Visual Studio to deploy the content types as solutions. That was solved in 2010 by the Content Type Hub. So the Content Type Hub allows us to have a central definition of content types that can then be consumed across site collections very, very easily. Another one is definitions of metadata. Again, in 2007, site columns, your lookups and choices and those kinds of things were really scoped to the site collection level. In 2010, the term store took care of that, where we elevated metadata into a centralized service, and that really solved at least 80% of the problem there. Content roll-ups are a problem still in 2010, where within a site collection, you can say, you know, what are the latest tasks in all the different sites, or what are the latest blog posts, or whatever the case may be. Your content by query web part can roll those up. But that only works within the scope of a site collection. Across site collections, you're out of luck. In 2013, that gets solved by analytics and content by search. So your new content by search web parts are designed to pull content from anywhere, even other farms. Your 2013 analytics will let you do things like top and most recent and those kinds of things. So there's some new features in 2013 that remove some of that pain. So a content publication is yet another. You've got a team working in a team site, and they are deciding what next year's benefits are going to be. When they're all finished, the definition of benefits needs to go onto the intranet, which is a whole other site collection or probably a whole other web app. How do you publish that content? How do you take content from a staging site and publish it to your intranet or public-facing website? That's been a challenge. Again, with 2013, Microsoft has come with solutions based on search. In 2010, there are some ways of doing that, and there's always third parties filling all these gaps. In 2013, there's a very good, at least 80% out-of-box solution to that. And last but not least, and the one that probably affects many of the technical people in this room, administration. It suddenly becomes a lot harder to administer SharePoint when you have more than one site collection. Because now, if you hire a new employee, you're having to add them to 2 or 4 or 20 site collections. When you want to audit someone who just caused a security breach, you need to go and pull audit logs from all of those different site collections. All of the administrative scopes are the site collections. So in other words, you've gone to multiple site collections to enforce policies, but now you've made your lives as administrators much harder. These things are solved by PowerShell and by third-party tools. So there are solutions to each of these, These are the blockers. These are the reasons why people say, oh, we're never going to have more than one site collection. We're going to do it all in one site collection. And the sort of bottom line here that I like to communicate to customers is that these challenges start as soon as you have two site collections. As soon as you have only two site collections in your environment, navigation is harder, administration is harder, content by query, content type, all these things, all these problems are there. So it really truly doesn't matter if you have two site collections or two web apps or two farms or on-prem and cloud, it's the exact same problems. So you want to address these problems or at least be aware of them early, because the sooner you can come up with a way of sort of thinking about how you're going to solve these problems as you go to your second site collection, then, and many of us have probably hundreds or thousands of site collections already, going to additional web apps and farms is no big deal because you've already thought about that problem. The problem doesn't change. So these are the challenges of a distributed architecture, and these need to be considered in the process because they have costs associated with them. How do you solve, what are the costs of these, of solving these problems in return for getting the management of the policy? So we've talked about a simple example. We've now sort of talked through some guidance at the lower levels of the architecture. We're going to move up to the harder technical solution, the harder technical issues, which are web apps and farms and things like that, cloud. But before we do that, I want to detail the process now, because we've sort of touched it, we've done it. Let's detail this. And this is the process of going from the definition of the business requirements to the design. And in my larger model, that's going from a yellow design to a green, or sorry, from a yellow defined to a green design. And this is what we're going to come up with. And by the time we're done with this and you understand it, my feedback from attendees in the past is that this is probably the single most valuable thing I can contribute to you. So if you pay attention to one thing, let it be this. And feel free to take this and use it or tweak it or destroy it, whatever you want. But hopefully it will help. So this diagram of going from defined to design starts with the inputs from the business. These are the things you're getting and soliciting from your business customers. They fall into categories, and many of us would call these the requirements, the business requirements. I try to purge that word R, thanks to Sue, if she's in the room, from this particular slide. And so we're now taking those inputs and breaking them into buckets, the first of which are business outcomes, and these are the most important ones. What are you trying to achieve? That's the question you ask. So let's use an example. Let's assume, sort of sticking with the human resources department, that in 2013 we're anticipating a growth of employee base. There's going to be a lot more recruiting. So we're going to be getting in a lot of those resumes. We're going to be scheduling interviews, hiring new people. And so that's the workload that we're bringing into our existing SharePoint environment. We already have an intranet. We already have some team sites. But now we have this recruiting solution that's coming in. So the business outcome is improve efficiency around the management of HR workflows from the reception of a resume to the scheduling of an interview to the hiring process. Those are the business outcomes. The second bucket are functional outcomes. Now, these are little ones like, oh, we like the site to be green and we want round buttons and we want, you know, flyouts, whatever. These are just functional preferences. Then there's technical considerations, and technical considerations are things like, last year, as part of our budget, we gave all the HR recruiters iPads. And they want to be able to read resumes on their iPads when they're on the train going to work, which means offline access. That is a technical consideration. Technical considerations basically involve interoperability with existing services in your IT portfolio. So the iPad is an existing service. We want to interoperate with it. That's a technical consideration. What a technical consideration is not is the HR director coming to you and saying, oh, we need this site with these many lists and libraries and these content types and these workflows. That is a design. And that's not what we're asking for. We're asking for what are the pieces that you perceive will help you achieve your business goals. Last but not least, perhaps most importantly, are the project constraints. How much money, time, and people, and resources, and skills do you have to apply to this project? So you get those inputs from the business, and so far so good, right? Now you have to go through what I would call generating the technical requirements that drive towards a design, or the solution requirements, and these are the red boxes. The first thing we're going to look at is the fact that you have to classify the information you're dealing with. This is a straightforward step, but if you don't do it, nothing else works. You have to look at the solution and say, what types of information are we dealing with? We're dealing with resumes that have personally identifiable information in them. We're dealing with interview appointments. We're dealing with whatever else they might be. We've got a couple classes of information. And from that, one of the first architectures we can actually build is our information architecture. So the information architecture is about describing content. Now, this is a term that I really encourage you to use correctly in your organization because much of the community abuses the term information architecture. Information architecture is about how you describe content. And from a technical standpoint, it ends up being things like metadata and content types and that kind of thing. And you describe the content so that it's findable later. That's one of the outcomes of information architecture. So one of the other elements about information architecture is your sitemap. You find it by browsing to it. Your search optimization, your best bets and keywords and managed properties. So that's what information architecture is. Information architecture is not things like permissions, because that's what's coming up next as information management. And information architecture as a discipline is about these things. Information architecture facilitates information management, but it is not itself information management. So the information architecture is at least those four things. We decide that resumes are PDFs and Word documents that have certain properties that we want to have available so that we can find them and search them and manage them later. We then go to the next step, which is we take that information classification and we have to determine what the information management requirements are. And here is where, in information management, we start creating policies that relate to security. What are the permissions around resumes? They must be accessible only by the HR organization. Now, how do we know that? It's because there's a policy. So this is one more input from the business. There's a policy that says resumes must be highly, HR information must be highly secure. Now, we have to then go to the business and say, this is the class of information we're dealing with. What are the policies around that class of information? And how many of you in your business have really well-defined information management policies? All right. How many of you, I'm glad if you do, how many of you realize that you probably should have the day you put a file server on the network in 1995? Because the policy is the same. It's not SharePoint that's giving you the need for that policy. We should have always had it. We just didn't. And so we've had information breaches, or risk at least. But we have to have those information management standards that apply to a class of information to determine what the information management policies will be. And the problem is many of us don't have these policies. So this is why you're pulling people to the table as governance. This is why governance needs to have this point in the process where you go and you ask, hey, what are we supposed to do with resumes? And it may be that the HR director can tell you. It may be that your lawyer can tell you. It may be that your security officer can tell you. It may be someone else can tell you, but find out what the policy is and document it. And if there isn't someone who can tell you what the policy is, who's authoritative and belongs to make that decision, make it up yourself. You've got to decide. So just say, okay, here's how we're going to treat resumes. And it doesn't have to be carved in stone. You might change your mind later when you find out what the real policy is. But you have to check the box and say, we thought about it. Here's what we decided. This was the compromise that was made because no one else could tell us what it was. And then you move on. But you've got to stop and define those policies, including security. But there's more. There's compliance. Are resumes records? According to the EU, they are. They must be maintained for a certain number of years, and then they must be deleted. It's not optional to delete them. You must delete them. Now, here's where information management policies influence information architecture. This is the link between them. If resumes are, in fact, records, then we probably should have a content type that separates them out from the standard document content type. And we might even think about having a folder for resumes that allows us to manage that as a record center rather than, you know, dumping them in with other HR documents. So there's definitely a link between information management and information architecture, and it's here. Another set of things that information management inform is your life cycle. What are your policies about how you're going to capture resumes? Are they being emailed in? Are they being uploaded? And then how are you storing them? How are you delivering them? This is part of the sort of presentation layer. Do they have to be accessible from a, you know, W3C layer or whatever? How are you preserving them? And finally, how are you deleting them? The whole information life cycle needs to be defined. And if you're curious about learning about the information lifecycle from a SharePoint perspective, my colleagues at AvePoint wrote a very good white paper that you can download that's really nice on that. So this is information management. You need to define these policies, or at least you need to think about them, because remember in an earlier slide I said you're not going to be able to think about everything all the time. You're going to have to triage. But as long as you've stopped at this base and said, what do I really have to think about? Okay, in this workload, resumes are probably important. Job interviews, I don't have time. The cost of defining those and figuring out what the policies are around an interview appointment, probably not worth it. So we're just going to skip and let that be whatever SharePoint lets it be. But you have to at least stop at the base and think about it. There was a question. Yeah. Yeah, so his question is, he's in the EU, so, you know, like all of us, we've got these regulations being pushed down on us, and his specific question is about data sovereignty. Where does the server live? That's something you need to find out. For a class of information, it might matter, and for many other classes, it won't. That's where your information management standards need to come in, and you need to find out the answer to that question. Now, excuse me, what I will tell you is that that specific issue of data sovereignty is a lot more about perception than about technical reality. So for example, in the EU, I commonly hear, oh, we can't use Office 365 because of the US Patriot Act. Microsoft's a US company, and so therefore the Patriot Act would allow the US government to seize data. And there's this big perception that that's different than anything else. It's not. Every country has the ability to go and grab data if something is really critical. It's just that our law in the United States is really, really blatant and public. But if something were going wrong in your country and you had data related to that, your government would be able to come in and get that data. It's called a subpoena in the United States. It's called other things in other countries. But so do realize that data sovereignty particularly often comes down to more the people's interpretation of the policy than the policy itself. I was talking with one of the folks from Azure yesterday, and they had been in Ireland working with an Irish bank. And they're like, oh, we can't use Office 365 because it's Microsoft's cloud. And Microsoft pointed out to them they've been using IBM's cloud for decades. You know, there's in another workload, you're running IBM's cloud. So you have to balance out perceptions with reality. But certainly data sovereignty would fall into this category. And there are certainly places where it does matter, to be sure. Now, the next step is then to define our service management policies. So service management is about how we provide this information. What's the uptime? Is it 95%, 99%, 3 nines, 4 nines, 5 nines? And of course, as uptime requirements increase, cost increases logarithmically. What is the data protection, the data integrity story? In other words, what happens if a user overwrites a resume and they need to recover that one document, the granular restore sort of scenario? What is the business continuity story? Do we need to have this replicated to another data center in case our business fails? So disaster recovery. What is the performance story? So part of service management that often doesn't get discussed during governance is, are you okay with this page taking 10 seconds to load? Or are you okay with it taking 40 seconds to load? What is the user's expectation of performance? Storage. So in this particular workload of resumes, we would want to say, okay, we know we're going to have to maintain resumes for 5 years. We've decided that. How many resumes are we going to get? Let's model that. And let's decide what the impact on our storage platform is. What are we going to need to own today? What are we going to need to own next year? Do we need to put in third-party tools to help us archive that onto cheaper storage over time? Storage is part of the service management piece. And finally, interoperability. Remember, we had a technical requirement to allow offline access to resumes on iPads. What does that mean from a policy perspective? Well, if we're going to put things on iPads and they are, by information management policy, needing to be encrypted, the service layer, need to add an element to our service that allows us to manage the distribution of information onto iPads. And there are some great third-party tools that do that, that allow you to say, okay, this information can go to these users on these iPads, and it must be encrypted. But that's going to be a service layer element that we need to add in order to support the technical considerations in combination with the information management policies. And so this is the base where we need to think about those kinds of things. Last but not least, then, we get to the green. We take all of those things, those requirements, the policies, and we start driving to an information architecture that helps us support that. So let's say that this is our existing architecture. We have team sites, social, and an intranet. We're now deciding, what do we need to support this new workload that we've just defined? And let's assume that we go through all the bases of backup and restore, which is service management and information architecture, and we decide that where we should architect this element in this workload into is as a new site collection in our team sites. So we're able to say our existing architecture can support this new workload if we put it in that location. And so what we've done there is we've now moved into the architectural design specification process. And all we need to do now is fill in a lot of technical details about the considerations of how we get there. And last but not least, when we've decided where that workload lives, we build it. And the functional preferences of, okay, they wanted the page green and they wanted the flyouts and the round buttons. We don't start designing the solution itself until we've architected it. And that's another mistake I see a lot of companies make, is they'll set the developers loose when they haven't even figured out, is this going to be on its own farm? Or in the cloud? You need to figure those things out first. Now, all of this together is a process that I use with my own customers, more or less, to get them through this and to make sure we've touched all the bases. And again, I don't expect that every time you're going to do everything right and perfectly and thoroughly, because there's a cost associated with doing it perfectly, and the cost is too high. You have to figure out what the compromise is. But there is a process. And for those of you who are scared of governance, this alone will ensure that you've done the things that are required on the front end and that you will enable the things that are required later to happen. This is the core of making governance actually work. So there is a process, and you can make this a process custom for you, do whatever you want with it. Then you also want to make sure that everyone involved with that process understands the difference between solicited requirements and derived requirements. Solicited requirements are those you're asking for. Derived requirements are decisions you are making based on the inputs. And this is where, if you get everyone to agree to that, all of a sudden you've addressed the problem where the HR director comes to you and says, I need this site with these site collections and these lists and workflows, because that is a green design, right? That's not a solicited requirement. Now, the challenge with that is, or actually the good and bad news is, he might be exactly right. That might be exactly what you need, and that's okay. And I hope over time, your business starts coming to you with the design, saying, here's what I need, and that they're right. I hope that's the case, and it will happen in many situations. But that's not enough. You then need to ask why. If they're coming to you with the green, you need to ask why, what led you to that decision, because you need to be able to track back those decisions. It's very important that for your workloads, you're able to say why we built it this way, which means what was the original input, who drove it, and then political, why it matters, what's the value of that input, and how is it going to be measured? For every input, you need to know these things. What is it you're doing, why, who does it matter to, and how is it going to be measured? And if you're able to track back to those decisions, but with someone coming to you and saying, here's my design, great, you've done your job. Perfect. And most importantly in this picture is for everyone in your governance team, in your business, in your organization to understand that this is a system, meaning each of these boxes, one reason I like this model, each of these boxes often is owned by a very different type of role in your organization. Legal owns the information management standards. Project management or finance owns the budget and the timeline. The business owner owns the outcomes. IT owns technical considerations and all of the red things in the middle. And everyone only cares about their bit. So everyone has to realize this is a system and no one can get their way. It has to balance out. And if something changes in the system, something else has to give. So for example, let's say we're taking this workload we've been discussing. We've already decided what the architecture should be. And before we start building the solution, HR comes and says, oh, you know what? While you're doing it, can you build our vacation request system? They add another desired outcome. They can't do that without something else changing. That something else might be more time and more money. It might be a different architecture. But the adjustment has to happen. And if people realize that this is a system and the adjustment has to happen, that's what creates the area for a discussion and a compromise. If you're in the middle of this project and your boss comes to you and says, oh, you know what, we have to slash your budget by 20%. Okay, which of our requirements are we going to have to give up? Do we give up storing resumes for 5 years in order to cut the storage budget? Cool. You had the process, and in all reality, it often ends up being IT in the red area in the middle. The process has to bubble up the concern, the risk, the change, so that the business can make the decision, so that the stakeholders can come to a compromise, and it's up to you to have the technical expertise to identify what those challenges are. And so the rest of the session is going to be, are these inputs that you've got to make sure you've thought about so that you can have an intelligent discussion with all of the stakeholders and that you don't miss something that later on you go, oh my God, we didn't even think about that. What will happen later is you'll have, oh my God, there's something new, a new regulation. This workload is suddenly more important than it was before. Something new is okay. Something that you didn't think about and exposed you to risk or failure, that's not okay. And so you need to balance those things out. So now let's move through the technical details of each of these different parts of the architecture. We left off at the site collection level. We talked about the fact that in at least a collaboration workload, there's generally a drive to push to each collaborative issue workload having its own site collection. Let's move up to the content database level. At the content database level, you're scoping storage management. That's really what it boils down to. And so you need to architect your content database level based on basic storage management considerations of how big you want the databases to be, how you're going to manage them from a backup and a replication and a high availability perspective, and performance. So you're basically going to look at those things. And let's say that in our scenario, we've decided, in our architecture, we've decided that we know engineering is going to be gigantic. It's going to be a big workload from a size perspective, and we don't want it to impact our backup and restore SLAs for HR and marketing. And we also realized that finance is business critical, which means we probably should be replicating it to an offline or to a different data center or something like that. In order to scope those sort of service management requirements, we're going to need to put engineering in its own content database that can grow without impacting the performance of other workloads in our environment. And HR, we're going to put in its own site collection and content database, I should say, so that we can use always-on availability groups to ensure that that's always there, or mirroring, or whatever else we choose to use. So content databases are actually a pretty straightforward one. Again, you've got to always be concerned about the scalability limits. So Microsoft documents how many content databases you can have in a web app, how many you can have in a farm. You've got to watch those limits. Moving up the line to web apps, this is where it starts getting really interesting, because here's where it starts getting complicated and costly, and then it gets really costly at the farm level. So at the web app level, one of the information management controls you need to think about is your service application connections. And this is easiest to understand with an example. Let's say that right now this is our architecture. We've got a team sites, and we've got a term store in our managed metadata service that has all the terms people can tag content with. Life is really great. Systems meeting all the business needs at this point. Then a new workload comes in, which is, oh, we want to have an extranet with clients. We want to be able to interact with clients through an extranet. And if you went through the yellow to green boxes, you might have decided that, oh, yeah, we'll just make that its own site collection. And because you might have considered certain management considerations, certain policy categories. But you missed a big one, which is the fact that service application connections are scoped at the web app level, which means this new workload, if it were placed here, would have the possibility that users in those clients would have access to terms in the term store that we don't want them to see. We have no way to guarantee that they can't see private terms that would otherwise show up in a keyword term set, for example. So in order to really scope this extranet for that consideration alone, we'd need to put the extranet in its own web app with its own managed metadata service, providing the terms for the extranet so that we can now guarantee that in that workload there's no exposure to the terms in the internal sites. So at that level, we've seen how service application connections work, and it's true about search and metadata particularly. Then we look at DNS isolation. And DNS isolation can also be scoped at the web app level. And the idea here is that if we start with that extranet in its own web app, it has a DNS name. And then we think, oh, you know what? After a year, that extranet would be easier to host in SharePoint 2013 in Office 365. You can now take that extranet and port it up to the cloud, to Office 365, fairly easily because you've got a DNS isolation already built into your architecture that allows that web application to be portable and to be moved. Now, there's obviously the technical issues of migration, too. But from a DNS perspective, you're able to get it out to a different location if you need to, which is nice. So that's one example there of DNS isolation. Another set of issues that are scoped at the web app level are IIS, application pool isolation, and performance, server assignment. So let me give you an example of this. So this is now our architecture, and I'm getting rid of the lower levels because they're just distracting now. This is our architecture now. We have a new workload, which is an intranet. So then also let's add social into the mix, our My Sites and stuff like that. Let's say that we have our team sites. Whenever you create a web app in SharePoint, it creates an IIS site, which can run in an app pool. So we've got our team sites running in an application pool. We might want to make sure that our extranet is in a separate application pool, because then those application pools can be running with separate credentials, which further ensures isolation of information, of content, between those two workloads. So then we add an intranet to the mix. It is its own IIS site. We can choose whether to put it in its own application pool or a shared application pool. We do the same thing for the next web application. We choose whether to put it into a shared application pool or a unique application pool. And in this case, we decide to put people, social, into the Teams application pool so that, basically, if the intranet goes down and we need to restart that application pool, it doesn't affect our team sites or social, and vice versa. We've got the ability to manage those application pools separately. And then again, we can have some security isolation on those accounts, too. So we can choose, by having these into their own web apps, how to manage our application pools effectively. Now, just as a bottom line guidance here, you're only allowed to have technically supported 10 application pools per server. So you definitely cannot have an unlimited number of application pools. And Microsoft's guidance, in fact, is to share application pools wherever possible. All web apps go into one application pool, all services go into a second, unless there's a really significant driver for either performance or security. And these are some good examples. Extranet would be a security example, peel that out. Intranet may be a performance example, peel that out. Another thing we can do by having separate web apps is decide which servers will host those web apps. And I'm being conceptual here, not technical, by the way. So we can decide how much performance we're going to dedicate to each of these. We might decide that the intranet and team sites are critical, so we're going to let all three of our web servers host those. But maybe our people and our extranet aren't so important, and so we're going to let certain servers host those from a performance perspective. Now, this is conceptual, because from a technical perspective, when you create a web app in SharePoint, it goes on all servers. But if you use load balancing or DNS, you can ensure that only certain servers actually serve up user requests for those sites. So you are in fact, managing performance by spreading these across IIS servers using load balancing. Portability is also a key. So let's add another workload into the mix. Let's say we're starting to get requests for what I call functional business applications. Now, functional business applications are things like your expense reporting, your vacation tracking, those kinds of things that every business has, and many your help desk that many of us want to put into SharePoint. This is particularly in SharePoint 2010, or if you're doing SharePoint-hosted solutions. I highly recommend putting those functional business apps into a single web application, as opposed to spreading them out between the finance site and the HR site and blah, 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 in those team sites. The reason, one of the many reasons, is for portability. If you're going to want to have a dev environment for those functional business apps, it's a lot easier to take this web app from a DNS and content database and service perspective and put that into your dev environment than to have to worry about the terabytes of content you have in your team sites and picking out just the bits you need for your dev environment. This makes it a very portable environment. There's also all kinds of other reasons, but it's definitely a best practice to have those apps in their own, those functional business apps in their own web application. Next example, business criticality. Now, this is a really key one. And as I go into customers that are more mature with SharePoint, this is often where they're at, is they're realizing that when they were going through their architecture process, they weren't thinking about this concept of criticality. Now, what criticality means will really vary to you. It might mean how highly performance must it be, how redundant must it be, how disaster, recovery capable must it be. The definition of that might vary, but it's scoped at least at the web application, if not at the farm level. And the sort of end story of this is going to be, let's look at our collaboration environment. Not all collaboration is created equal. If you were to look at your collaboration workloads in this architecture, you might be able to pick out which one the business needs in case the data center goes down. Finance, perhaps. Maybe engineering too, but certainly finance. And if that's business critical, we're going to be well served to have it at least in its own web application. Because then from many service level perspectives of DNS and database replication and blah, 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 we're going to be able to easily scale that to meet or support the different criticality elements that they might be putting at us. So at least at a web app level. And so where we're heading is the idea that you have a gold collaboration environment that's locked down and secure and highly performant and highly redundant and highly available, whatever that definition of criticality is. And then you've got this sort of loosely managed Wild Wild West environment that's appropriate for the types of information in there. And this one thing addresses one of the serious tensions I see in organizations, where either IT created SharePoint and they created such a lockdown environment that it's not responsive to the business. And business users say, oh my God, it takes me 3 weeks to get a team site. I'm just going to go out and do Dropbox. So that's one extreme. The other extreme is it was driven by the business. It's chaos, and IT is trying to figure out how to manage it. It's all wild, wild west. You're going to have both. You need to architect for both. You're going to need a clean environment, a dirty environment, a wild, wild west environment, a lockdown environment. And the reality is, as soon as you admit that and you architect to it, your tension disappears. Because those users who expect responsiveness, they're almost always going to belong in that wild, wild west environment. The finance and legal and HR, they're going to be okay with it taking a little longer because they realize they're dealing with classes of information that have to be managed differently. So their expectations are different. And they'll be okay with it being a little bit more vetted to go into the lockdown environment because they want to ensure that their stuff is vetted and locked down for everyone else too. So a gold collaboration environment would be another web app. The final one would be line of business. So for example, your project management, your CRM, your ERP, each one of those should be at least its own web application, separate web app. And there are several reasons for that. which include service, include things like redundancy and information management and such. So to cut to a guidance on web apps, if someone comes to me and says, what web apps do I need for my SharePoint world? There's never best practices. You have to start with what the business is doing. But this is a really good list of a starting point. Intranet is separate from team sites, which is separate from extranet. Within your team sites, there's going to be different web apps for lockdown, gold collaboration versus Wild Wild West bronze collaboration. Social is in its own for a whole bunch of reasons. A single web apps for all of your functional business apps, like time reporting and expense reporting and all those things, and then one for each of your line of business apps. Now, you have to do all of this within your scalability limits, which are, from a supported standpoint, in 2013, they've announced this. In 2010, this was a best practice. 20 web apps per farm. And the reality is, it is so dependent on memory and performance that unless you're dumping tons of money into your hardware, it's closer to 10. So you're somewhere between 10 and 20 web apps per farm and 5 to 10 app pools per server. Within that, scope out your web applications, and this is what it might look like. And if you want me to say one thing that's prescriptive, just say, do this, and I promise you it's going to serve you well, this would be one of those things. Now, from this level, we move up to farms. And one of the advantages of having web apps in the right place is, again, from a DNS and a service perspective, it makes it easy for you to scale out at the farm level. So you might, for example, decide that extranet should go into Office 365. You might decide that your critical workloads are so critical they should be on a highly available farm with a 99.9% uptime. You might decide that your team sites and intranet and people should be upgraded to SharePoint 2013 because it's got these amazing new features. You upgrade that farm, but you leave your app farms at 2010 because those are running your expense report application and it already meets your business requirements. It doesn't need to benefit from any features of 2013. So you're able to make your upgrade and migration processes more granular. And your line of business farm is put into a separate farm so that it is able to run at a higher SLA, and so you're able to charge back more easily to that part of the organization. Because one of the other tensions I see in SharePoint organizations is that IT gets really tired of hosting all of the specific line of business apps under its budget. And so it's much easier to provide these information management and service management controls. So we've actually talked through each of these scenarios, so I'm going to skip through some of these. Service level agreements, charge back for having a farm for a line of business app, for example. Upgrade and update. So this was the idea of updating your SharePoint environment to 2013, but leaving your apps in 2010. And one other best practice, I know Jeremy had this on his slide, I really am encouraging companies to consider this strongly, which is have a clean service farm, at least for now. A clean service farm means your search, BCS, metadata, and profiles are in a separate farm, which means you can update and upgrade and apply service packs to that farm much more easily than if it's in your content farm with all of your funky customization and third-party tools in there. In addition, that means you can look at moving your service farm to 2013 very quickly, as quickly as possible, because 2013 has some amazing capabilities in the services. Think about search, for example. You move search as a service into the 2013 farm. You also put your enterprise search center in 2013. And you've got all the amazing new capabilities of search that used to require fast licenses from just the straight eCal of SharePoint, and you're still running your farms in 2010. Because SharePoint 2013 services can be consumed by 2010 farms. You don't magically get the features in those 2010 farms. So search in 2010 will look like 2010. Global navigation does not consume term store map navigation in those 2010 farms. But everything you're doing when you consume search can be consuming the index and the query from the centralized service farm. So that's a good thing to think about. Licensing and support also is an issue as you get to more farms. I'll talk about that in just a second. And then geo-availability and geo-performance. So let's put these into the mix. The line of business farm going into its own farm, the line of business workload going into its own farm. As people add more farms, you have to think, okay, that means more licenses, potentially. But it also might not, because it might be instead of having 6 servers in one farm, you're having 4 in one and 2 in another. It may not be more servers. It may be a little bit higher from a support perspective, because many of Microsoft's support contracts are based on farms. You also have to think about licensing of third-party tools. And here's one example where doing it right can actually lower costs. Project management going into its own farm. There's a lot of reasons for that I like. One of them is the most mature project management organizations I've seen on SharePoint end up using Nintex project management workflows, because it's a phenomenal tool. The problem with Nintec's project management workflows, as I understand it, is they are licensed per user in the farm. So if you have a 500-user project management office in an 80,000-person company, you're buying 80,000 licenses for Nintec's project management workflows. Whereas if you peel PMO into its own farm, your costs just drop significantly. So licensing is not always more expensive when you go to multiple farms. You have to look at the whole picture of what you're doing in your environment. Another example is your branch office. So you've got a branch, you've got your data center in Las Vegas, you've got your branch office in Singapore. Might make sense to have that be its own farm for either data availability perspective, so that if the WAN link goes down, they can still do their business with the right data in the right place, and also from a geo-performance perspective of uploading and downloading documents might be faster locally than over the wire. There's different scenarios where that's possible. So farms give you a lot of capability, and particularly in 2010, there were a lot of organizations who are more mature in SharePoint are going to many, many farm models in order to really manage the policies that their business is asking them to manage to. These are some examples. The main point here is that you need to think about these things. This is certainly a place where cost is more likely to come into play, and you often will have to make a compromise and say, no, we just can't give you the SLA you want in our existing farm. And then you have to make the compromise of, are you going to invest more to have us create a farm that gives you the SLA you want, or are we going to have a risk that we assume and we agree to accept? And that's that compromise. So make sure you document what you do. At the farm level, there's a couple of additional challenges of going to multiple farms that I want to point out, one of which is service management. As soon as you have more farms, you're having to worry about backing up and restoring more farms and managing storage in more farms. That's where PowerShell can help a little. Third-party tools can help a lot. And last but not least, the hard costs. So those are the things you need to think about at the management level. So in sum, architecting based to achieve a solution that delivers your business need is straightforward. There is a process you can go through, and you can touch each base, and you can make sure you thought about everything. But it's not easy, particularly because there's people involved. And if people don't understand the process or they aren't willing to be part of the compromise, that's where it gets hard. But there is a process. Make sure you consider all of the available policies as you define your requirements. So as you're going from yellow to green in that red area, you need to be looking at all those orange charts I've given you and say, have we thought about each of these things? At least given it some thought and agreed not to think any more about it. Then identify the controls and scopes that help you support the management of the policies you're trying to implement. Measure the cost of enforcing those versus the risk of not enforcing. And document, document, document. Because after this step of governance comes management. And you're going to need to know what your environment is. You're going to need to be able to measure it and monitor it and make sure it's meeting your business expectations. And if you've documented all of these decisions, you will be able to do that. There's a bunch of resources as the last slide in the deck. The first URL on this slide is the link to my SkyDrive. The deck is already there for you. And with that, I'd like to say thank you guys so much for coming to SharePoint Conference 2012 and allowing me to be part of it. Thank you so much.